Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Republicans are talking jobs this week. Democrats are talking jobs this week. And what do you know? So are we. What happens when so many people don't have one? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's the 7th of September today. Glad you could be with us on this Wednesday for another installment of The Breakdown, our economy one step at a time. There is business news to be had today, and we'll get there in a bit. But this week, we're doing something a little special, a week of jobs, where they're going to come from, who's going to pay for them, and today, what happens when people don't have them. Best guesses are that in the face of 9% unemployment, as much as a third of the American workforce has some kind of non-traditional job. That's a shift towards freelance gigs and contracting work that's nothing less than a structural change in how the American economy works. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports that the idea of working 9-to-5 for 40 years is going the way of the pension and the gold watch.
34-year-old Melissa Holsinger has a law degree from New York University. She has several years of corporate law experience and did a clerkship for a federal judge. But since she and her husband moved from Tennessee to New York last year, getting a job at a law firm has proven impossible.
I thought I'd be snapped up, that I had good credentials, and I wouldn't have a problem finding a job. And you know, for the first 6 months, I don't think I had a single interview.
So Holsinger took a job at a coffee shop where a customer told her about some contract work at his law firm. She's worked for several firms now, with stints varying from a week to several months.
I sort of just tripped into it. It wasn't anything I'd planned to do.
More Americans are tripping into the world of contract work and out of the traditional workplace. Some 42 million people are freelancing, juggling part-time assignments and going from gig to gig. It's part of a major shift in our labor market, says Sarah Horowitz. She's CEO of the Freelancers Union, which offers members access to health care and other benefits. Horowitz says 10 years ago, most of her members worked in areas like media and graphic design. But these days, freelancing is a fact of life in every profession.
It's finance, it's healthcare, the nonprofit sector.
The trend started as technology changed employers' needs, but the sour economy has made contract work especially attractive to companies, says economist Ken Goldstein.
It not only relieves them of having to pay for the whole benefit package, but also if things indeed worsen, they can let these people go because there's no commitment to keeping these people.
With less opportunity for real job security, many job hunters expect they'll have to cobble together several gigs. Work and culture expert Andrew Ross hears that from his students at NYU.
They're terrified, quite frankly.
Ross says students are preparing themselves for the freelance economy by spreading themselves thin.
More and more students are doing double majors or cramming in as many minors as they can to equip themselves with as many skills as they can amass.
27-year-old filmmaker Malcolm Wallace Murray has been freelancing for 4 years. Between shoots, he writes and edits in his kitchen. He says he loves the freedom of the freelance life, but the lack of security can be hard.
Especially now that I have friends who are settling into career trajectories and they can see 10 years out what their life is going to look like. And I don't know, there still is quite a bit of risk in mind.
And risk is the real problem a growing number of people face in the contract economy, says Sarah Horowitz of the Freelancers Union. She says these workers have to take responsibility for their own health care, their own training, their own retirement savings.
We're putting all the risk and the cost onto the worker. So when you have enough gigs, you're doing fine. When you don't have enough gigs, you are not doing fine. And to top it off, you're not entitled to unemployment insurance.
From her Brooklyn apartment, lawyer Melissa Holsinger says she's one of the lucky freelancers. She gets health insurance through her husband's job. Even so, she says the instability wears on her.
Well, there are definitely times that I've said, you know, what else can I do in my life? And law school was a huge mistake. But, you know, I still enjoy the work when I'm doing it. So, you know, you just keep plugging along and eventually that full-time position will come through.
Holsinger has an interview for yet another part-time position on Friday. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, yeah, no, the markets don't make any sense to me either. We'll have the details and the happy music when we do the numbers. Part of what we're talking about today and all week is what happens when the labor market is as lousy as the American labor market is. One thing could be that lousy becomes the new normal, and that doesn't sit well at all with commentator Robert Reich.
Even if we produce new jobs at the best rate we've achieved this past decade, we wouldn't get back to 6% unemployment, the old normal, until 2024. And if job growth stays as anemic as it's been for the last few months, we won't get back there for a generation. Some say 9% is the new normal because Americans have priced themselves out of the global high-tech labor force. They say we won't get jobs back again until real wages drop 20%. But there's no reason the inhabitants of the richest and most productive nation in the world must be condemned to high unemployment or low wages. This can't be the new normal because it's not sustainable economically. A population suffering years of joblessness or low wages won't be able to buy what the economy could otherwise produce. That means a downward, vicious cycle toward even higher unemployment and lower wages. And it's not sustainable politically, because Americans won't stand for it. One way or another, they'll demand change. At the ballot box, or even eventually in the streets, we'll elect reformers who will bring back jobs and wages, or demagogues who scapegoat immigrants, foreign nations, the poor, unions, religious minorities, even government itself. And that would mean another downward vicious cycle. That's why the stakes are so high and why the president must be bold when he issues a new jobs plan tomorrow. A new WPA and Civilian Conservation Corps, $500 million of infrastructure spending, loans to cash-starved states, a plan for government to buy up mortgage debt in exchange for equity stakes when homes are eventually sold. If Republicans won't go along, take it to the people. Make it the centerpiece of the 2012 campaign. America needs bold leadership now. A so-called new normal of lost jobs and lower wages isn't normal at all.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week in this slot, David Frum. In the meanwhile, send us your thoughts, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. So let's say the arguments Bob Reich was just making don't carry the day, that 9% unemployment, or maybe something a little bit less, becomes the new normal. What happens then? Not in a gross domestic product kind of way, but in a people kind of way. Don Peck of The Atlantic Magazine writes about exactly that in his new book, Pinched. Don, good to have you with us.
It's my pleasure, Kai.
I want to start with something you wrote in The Atlantic about a year and a half ago that we talked about on the show at the time. You say there's unemployment, you know, regular old unemployment, and then there's, in italics, unemployment that really lasts and endures. What's the difference? And I mean, what does that look like?
Well, I mean, Rutgers actually just did a poll of people who'd been unemployed for more than 7 months, which is less than the average duration of unemployment in the U.S. today. And they found that more than half of the respondents were withdrawing from friends, were reporting stressful marriages, were not sleeping regularly. 15% had acquired a substance abuse habit. When you have a situation where people just can't find work month after month, it changes them. Being unemployed for more than 6 months is about the worst thing that can happen to you. Psychologically, it's equivalent to the death of a spouse, and it's a kind of bereavement in its own right.
Does it change depending on how old you are? And I ask because I'm thinking, for some reason, of young people in this economy and all the research that shows, you know, if you don't get a job out of college, you pay the price your whole life in a wage gap and in upward mobility and all of that.
People who struggle early in bad jobs or in no jobs because of a weak economy not only start behind, they never fully catch up. Even 10, 15, 20 years later, they're making less than they otherwise would have, and they're stuck disproportionately in low-status jobs.
We are, you know, depending on who you talk to, halfway through a lost decade. We're 5 years in. How much longer do we have before it's too late to change some of these effects?
Well, I mean, we're already seeing changes. Our politics have become meaner in this period. Anti-immigration sentiment has swelled. Support for the poor has diminished. These things are all common in periods like this.
When you say politics get meaner, you don't mean that Republicans and Democrats yell at each other more. You mean that there is a cut to benefits for people in need. There's anti-immigrant sentiment. There's all of that stuff.
When times are hard for long periods of time, it actually becomes harder and harder for the government to engage in creative, large-scale public actions, really to get much of anything done, because the entire atmosphere, regardless of Republican versus Democrat, becomes poisoned by a sense of discontent, insecurity for people in office. And that's yet another risk of this period.
Well, let me end then with a question about those policies and the idea that personal conservatism, when the economy is rough and when these things happen, leads to larger national conservatism, that people want the government to be counting their pennies as well, like regular people have to. And what that might mean for, say, the president's speech tomorrow night and any real chance of stimulus.
It makes me somewhat skeptical that the stimulus will happen. You know, when you look at prior recessionary periods, in 1936, people were likewise concerned about growing government debt. The government did actually slash spending, raise taxes in 1937. Stock market crashed, unemployment went up again, and we had another 5 years of depression. So it's kind of a natural psychological reaction after a bubble bursts to become more personally conservative, to become averse to risk and to debt of any kind. So what we're seeing now, what we've seen over the past few months, is really quite natural, but it's also quite counterproductive. And all we can do is try to guard against that.
Don Peck, he's a features editor for The Atlantic Magazine. His book is called Pinched: How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Don, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, September 11th, and what we can't do because of it.
9/11 introduced us to a world of terrorism. It caused us to have to shift our emphasis. Keep in mind, our local governments only have so many resources.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, there was some good news on the European debt crisis today. That gave stocks a kick in the pants. The Dow Industrials jumped 275 points, nearly 2.5%, closed at 11,414. The Nasdaq jumped 75 points, 3%, 2548 at the bell. The S&P 500 bounced up nicely, 33 points, nearly 2.9%, ended things at 1198. Bank of America pocketed a gain of 7% as investors cheered a management shakeup at the struggling lender. Other financials followed. Morgan Stanley deposited 6.5% today. Best Buy got even better by 5%. The big box retailer said it's going to offer items online from other sellers to compete with Amazon and eBay. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.05%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues its monthly report on international trade. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release consumer credit data for July. And the Treasury Department holds a symposium, 10 years later, progress and challenges in combating terrorist financing since 9/11. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. To carry our theme of the day into the second half of the show, jobs and what happens when people don't have them, there's a report out today from the Department of Agriculture on Americans who don't have enough to eat. The absolute number of people going hungry in this country is holding steady, but only because of programs like food stamps and free school lunches. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
The government says that last year, almost 33 million Americans were what it calls food insecure. That is essentially they couldn't afford to eat right. An additional 16 million people were very food insecure, which means they couldn't always afford to eat enough. That's about the same as it's been since the economic crisis began, when the number of Americans at risk of hunger went up dramatically. Chris Room is an economics professor at the University of Virginia. He says it is important to know how many people were hungry last year, but the real question is this.
If we look over the next year, are you concerned that you're not going to have enough to eat?
He says the deterioration of the employment picture over the last couple of months is worrying. Mark Edwards is a sociology professor at Oregon State University. He says,
even if you have people finding jobs, if those are not jobs that pay well, they still may remain food insecure.
His concern is that these levels of hunger could become the new normal. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Yahoo's now former CEO Carol Bartz had a rough afternoon yesterday. She was fired, as you might have heard, over the phone, in no small part because Yahoo just ain't what it used to be. That's a problem that predates Bartz, we should say. But the company helped millions of people find their way around the internet for the first time. It was once the undisputed leader in online advertising, how long ago that seems, and it created an enormous online audience. Catch is, it still has that audience, but it can't figure out how to make money off them. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more now on what it might take to turn Yahoo around.
Yahoo makes its money selling online ads. This industry is booming, and Yahoo's reach is enormous, 600 million unique visitors a month. So why are Yahoo's revenues flat and its market share shrinking?
More and more ad dollars are going to more targeted buys.
David Hallerman's at eMarketer.
Whether it's on Facebook, where they have information about people's friends and contacts.
Or on Google, where search data is used to place ads all over the web. Shervan Boskirk at Forrester Research says Yahoo has other problems, too.
They lack focus. They are an email business. They're a database marketing business. They're an ad agency. They're a marketing platform. They're a search engine. And all of those things are a little bit too scattered for an advertiser or for a user to really clearly understand when and why to go to Yahoo.
Van Boskirk believes those individual pieces might be worth more on their own.
Ultimately, the future here might be for an investment bank to buy Yahoo and spin off the parts.
And rumors are rampant today that Yahoo's board may finally put the company up for sale. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Firefighters in Texas are beginning to gain control of the wildfires there. More than 170 fires have started in just past week, fueled by high winds and a year-long drought. Four deaths so far. Hundreds of homes have been lost. Colin McDonald is the environment reporter for the San Antonio Express News. He was out in Bastrop County, about 25 miles east of Austin earlier today. Thanks for being with us.
Hello.
First things first, I suppose, what's the latest on the fire from where you see it?
There's multiple fires. Today we have much lighter winds than we did earlier this week, so the containment numbers are going up. Hopefully, if the winds stay below 10, 15 miles an hour, they have a much better chance of actually getting containment.
Remind us, would you, how many structures have been lost? Last number I saw was 800.
Total statewide, it's more than 1,000. Because the fires are not controlled, the firefighters aren't focusing on counting the number of structures that have burned. They're focusing on protecting the ones that haven't burned. But statewide, this year, we've probably lost at least 1,200. In the last week, we've lost over 1,000.
The impression a lot of us have just from reading the news reports is that basically the whole state of Texas is on fire. That's not true, but it's a wide swath of the state, isn't it?
Yeah, there are fires across Texas right now. Of the 254 counties, 251 of them have burn bans, from the grasslands of West Texas to the pine woods of East Texas.
Early on when these fires started, were state firefighters in a position to have enough people and enough bodies to get in there and fight these fires, or have state budget cuts sort of done their number down there as well?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. Yes, the state budgets have been cut, but this year we've been on basically high alert for fires since March. We're now in the 10th driest month ever in the history of Texas. We've had high winds. We've had big fires since April. And so we've had federal crews, state crews, and local crews positioned and on high alert all summer.
Colin McDonald, he's the environment reporter for the San Antonio Express News. We got him in the newsroom in San Antonio. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The fires in Texas, believe it or not, give me a pretty good segue into today's story on the economic legacy of September 11th. It's been 10 years, and depending on how you count it, trillions of dollars since the attacks. That's part of what we talked about yesterday. Today, though, we ask a different question. Has all the money being put into preventing man-made disasters, terrorism, made us less prepared for the disasters created by Mother Nature? We put Gregory Warner on a plane to Tulsa to go find out.
When I arrived in Tulsa, Oklahoma this August, it had been a busy week for Roger Jolliffe, emergency manager for the city. Record heat, record drought, and grass so dry that a few sparks from a pickup truck set off a wildfire that burned 15 homes to the ground.
Since this fire, we've had two storm events that have caused damage in town.
One with hurricane-force winds that left 16,000 homes without power.
Then we had the event, count my days, Tuesday night.
A near miss with a tornado that killed a woman just east.
So, we stay busy.
Also in the past 2 weeks, Jolliffe's met with the FBI and Homeland Security about terrorism procedures. He spent several days devising a terrorism attack scenario to which local law enforcement will have to respond. Because when Jolliffe isn't dealing with natural disasters, he's often planning for man-made ones.
9/11 introduced us to a world of terrorism. It caused us to have to shift our emphasis. Keep in mind, our local governments only have so many resources, so many widgets of time to address things.
In other words, he has less time to prepare for the tornadoes and floods he knows are coming. Kathleen Tierney directs the Natural Hazard Center at the University of Colorado at Boulder. She says, as a country,
we are less prepared for natural disasters. Yes.
In the last decade, the Department of Homeland Security has handed out $36 billion to states to buy special equipment like decon suits and chem labs and also do training in counterterrorism. But the money did not buy more personnel. Local budget cuts in Tulsa and other cities made emergency management departments smaller.
If you're asking these same people who have a limited amount of time to prepare for exotic terrorist attacks, they're not going to have time to do the ordinary outreach that they need for the disasters that they will face.
If you quit educating the public about how to take care of themselves in disasters, sooner or later you're going to be less prepared as a community to deal with a disaster.
So let's look at Jolliffe's workday before 9/11. Well, in the late 90s, Tulsa joined a FEMA pilot project called Project Impact.
Project Impact is an initiative that we became involved in 1998.
I wish the radio audience could appreciate, but your eyes just light up when you say this Project Impact word.
Okay, well, I'm excited about this.
Here's why he's still so excited, 13 years later. Project Impact grants were given by FEMA to cities to fund projects that would reduce the cost of disasters before they happened. This was kind of a fantasy come true for Roger Jolliffe, or anyone who spends their days thinking about disaster. Suddenly, communities were coming together to talk about building tornado shelters, or clearing floodplains, or helping homeowners put wind clips on their roofs.
Just lots of basic things, many of which don't cost that much money. You just need to give some thought to, and also make it the quote-unquote cool thing to do.
If disaster cool sounds also 1990s, well, this was the decade we weren't at war with anyone, except for global warming. The idea was to make preparedness a social good, like recycling. Scott Gabriel Knowles teaches history at Drexel University in Philadelphia.
There is no such thing as a natural disaster became a kind of phrase used at that time to say that disasters are of our own making. We build in a floodplain. We build on a fault line. And that was really gathering steam throughout the 1990s. And so then 9/11 happens, and it pushes that consensus aside.
After 9/11, FEMA was put under the Department of Homeland Security, and that shifted the funding and also the culture of disaster planning.
If terrorism is your overriding concern, that's a war-type concern, which means that secrecy is involved. It means that these community groups that can feed into preparedness in the 1990s, well, you're not going to be able to listen to them quite as much.
After Hurricane Katrina, he says that funding shifted slightly, but the closed-off military culture did not. Now, there is a guy in Washington trying to change that.
My name is Craig Fugate. I'm the administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Fugate's introduced something new to FEMA called the Whole Communities Approach. It's as much about bringing back what FEMA started before 9/11 as about trying to survive in the lean times of 2012.
With the limited resources that we're going to have, we're going to have to be more aggressive about bringing in team members that have resources and capabilities. That's going to be the private sector, volunteer organizations, and other groups out there that have not traditionally been part of these teams.
What he's saying about limited resources? Hurricane Irene just kicked us into a record year for disaster spending, and FEMA's budget took a big hit this year, while counterterrorism money was actually increased.
So when I emailed FEMA later to tell me how many staffers they actually have building community preparedness, I was told it's really more of a mindset than a specific program. Meanwhile, one other thing happened after 9/11. Remember, the Federal Reserve untapped a stream of cheap money that spurred a housing boom. Well, we built homes in floodplains, on fault lines, and in the paths of hurricanes and tornadoes, which means that while we may be less prepared for natural disasters, there's more of us living in harm's way. In Tulsa, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
There's more about the economic legacy of September 11th tomorrow on the program and on our website. The facts and figures from Gregory's story and how September 11th compares to other disasters, man-made as well as natural. It's Marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, it has come to this. The European debt crisis explained in Legos. Seriously. An analyst at J.P. Morgan apparently got with one of his kids, the 9-year-old, it seems, and put together a chart of what the heck is going on over there with Lego figures as illustrations, published it in an official J.P. Morgan research note. Does kind of clear the whole thing up, I have to say. There's a link to it on our website, marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. All three major indices up today and up strong. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest installment of The Breakdown, Our Economy, One Step at a Time. And coming up next time back here, President's giving a job speech tomorrow, you know. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.